scholar Ibram X. Kendi joins the program to speak directly to South Dakotans. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, August 5th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Governor Kristi Noem's recent executive order mentions the writer and historian Ibram X. Kendi and his work. We've been talking about that work for weeks on the air. Now we get to hear from Kendi himself. We offer insight into the South Dakota drought with a drought monitor update, an analysis of danger lurking in stock dams, and the impact on an individual farmer. Plus, we hear music inspired by myth and legend. We highlight the work of Superior Siren later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. The Biden administration is replacing its old eviction ban with a new one that applies only to counties with high or substantial spread of the coronavirus. That covers 32 of South Dakota's 66 counties, according to CDC data. Meanwhile, the state has only distributed 4% of its housing aid from the federal government. SDPB's Ariel Zions has more.
The old and new moratoriums ban landlords from evicting tenants who can't pay their rent as long as the tenants meet certain conditions. Tenants must pay as much rent as possible, apply for aid, and fall within income guidelines. The old moratorium expired Sunday after the Supreme Court ruled it can't be extended. The Biden administration created the new partial ban after pressure from activists and some Democratic lawmakers. Brent Thompson is the director of East River Legal Services. He saw an increase in eviction filings toward the end of the old moratorium.
You know, we've been really trying to get the word out about the government assistance that's been available through the CARES, various CARES Acts, you know, that people use that. So hopefully that buys us more time to make more people aware of that.
The South Dakota Housing Development Authority has distributed about $13 million, or 4%, of its $320 million in aid from the federal government. The moratorium is meant to prevent people from moving into shelters and other shared living spaces where the virus is more likely to spread. It's expected to cover the vast majority of the country through October 3rd. Pennington, Minnehaha, and Hughes counties are among the 32 South Dakota counties protected by the eviction ban. Evictions for non-payment can resume in Brookings, Yankton, Davison, and 31 other counties. Landlords can still evict tenants who break laws or lease rules. For information on aid, visit sdcareshousingassistance.com or call 211. I'm Ariel Zients with SDPB News.
Sanford Health's nurse residency program is now fully accredited with distinction. The health system worked to earn the honor from the American Nurses Credentialing Center during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Erica DuBoer is Chief Nursing Officer with Sanford Health. She says the program enhances training for new nurses.
The nursing residency program is powered not only by the preceptors at the bedside that are helping with those clinical skills, but we have phenomenal facilitators and mentors that really help our new nurses as they onboard, not just into that clinical setting, but helps them develop add their leadership skills, as well as all those care standards and the evidence to deliver that quality outcomes to our patient.
Only 200 other nurse residency programs around the world have earned the same accreditation. The Department of Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and Attorney General Merrick Garland are working to establish the Not Invisible Act Commission. It's in response to the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis in the United States. They are seeking members to focus on reducing violent crimes against American Indians and Alaska Natives. The commission includes partnerships with tribal, state, and federal law enforcement and other social service providers to accomplish that goal. Secretary Haaland encourages input from tribal nations about the focus and direction of the commission. This commission is the next step of the Not Invisible Act. Four Native American members of Congress, including then-Congresswoman Haaland, introduced the act in 2019. Congress passed the act unanimously in 2020. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist. She's joining us now for our weekly update on the South Dakota drought. She's with us from SDPB's Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio at Northern State University. Laura, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
I sat outside in the city of Sioux Falls with my feet in the rain last night, and I wondered what the impact was going to be. We appreciate every drop.
Yeah, every drop counts, and I've said that more than one occasion. The other thing that has really helped us at least hold steady, not get worse on the drought this last week, was cooler temperatures. Yeah. And there's been a lot of discussion, especially due to the smoke cover that we've had over the last week.
Yeah. So what is the update today? Drought Monitor is released on Thursday morning. So here we are.
Yeah, we haven't had too much of a change in the drought monitor this week. A little expansion of the D3 extreme drought area kind of over the Flandreau area. And that's really kind of connecting an area that we have in our southeast corner over to Minnesota, which has seen continuing degradation in their drought situation over there.
And what sort of an outlook are we looking for the days ahead? Do we get a little more of these cool temperatures and occasional showers?
I hope we get some more rain. I think the eastern side of the state looks more likely as we look ahead towards the weekend. We see okay chances, maybe decent 20 to 50% chance of rain in the eastern part of the far eastern part of the state over the weekend. Maybe an inch or inch and a half or so, which would be really great. But the rest of the state, really, we don't see a lot of moisture in the next 7 days. And we're going to see temperatures creep back up into the 90s for a lot of us, which is now, you know, push in 5 to 10 degrees above average for this time of year. So unfortunately, I think we're going to return towards warmer and drier conditions for most of the state in the next 1 to 2 weeks.
I keep pushing for optimism, and I keep learning that the seriousness of the situation is really that part is unchanged. When we look at August, traditionally, as we're entering August now, really, what do we normally expect? And tied into what you said about, you know, this is above normal, we also talked recently about the new normals for climate as well.
Yeah, average temperatures to start off August this time of year are in the low 80s or so, 82 to 84. Low temperatures around 60, more or less, depending where you are in the state. So we will be above average, and that's what the outlook for the month of August shows. That was released last Saturday by NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. They're also forecasting or showing drier than average conditions for much of the month as well. And average precipitation is about half an inch a week or so this time of year. We're kind of on the downhill slide, as our wettest time is usually in June and July. So climatologically speaking, our chances of really having a good recovery of drought are kind of slipping away slowly as we get through August.
Right. Tell me a little bit about when we talked about those, that smoke, that haze that we were all breathing and really being concerned about air quality, wildfire season, expecting a very active one, you know, on an ongoing basis. Any way you can put that into perspective before we let you go?
Yeah, sure. Air quality is certainly a concern with the smoke and haze, but also having that kind of blanket over us has cooled our temperatures down and reduced how much direct sunlight we have coming in. So that's kind of reduced the heat stress on our crops, corn, soybeans, and also our lawns and gardens. We saw a little reduction in water demand, you know, from cities like Sioux Falls and on the water system. Which are really just on the cusp, I think, of having some more water restrictions put into place. But yeah, it's kind of been pro and con, depending which way you look at it, from the agriculture side or the human health side.
Sure. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist, and she's been joining us every week as we endure this drought through much of the state. Laura, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Lori.
Researchers are studying the immediate impacts of the drought. We'll talk stock dams and salinity after the break. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
After July 4th, a statistician got a text from a friend just back from vacation in Provincetown.
Not sure if you've heard, but looks like everyone from P-Town is getting COVID.
Most of them were vaccinated, so he started making a list. When it grew to 50 cases, he sent it to the CDC. How a citizen scientist helped piece together the Provincetown outbreak. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Stock dams are an essential component to the family farm in South Dakota. Livestock head there to soak up fresh water and graze. The water level and quality is a strong indicator of the overall environmental health of an operation. And because of current drought impacts, many stock dams are in trouble. Patrick Kozak is a scientist and graduate of South Dakota Mines. He's joining us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio for an update on his research. Patrick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Explain to people who are not in the world of agriculture. Stock dams can be man-made, natural occurring. Like, give us a definition of what a stock dam is and why it's important.
So for our research and work, stock dams are man-made impoundments or placements to catch and collect water on drainage runs. And in western South Dakota, there's about 77,000 of these man-made impoundments. And so what we're out there doing is looking at these because there's no real sources of naturally occurring surface water year-round in western South Dakota. It's been important for ranchers out here to have these stock dams for water for livestock. And so we're out looking at these now, doing a multi-year study. We started the research in 2018. This year, I've gone out monthly, starting in April, looking at the conditions on those impoundments. And that would include the water levels, those types of things, temperature, and salinity by looking at the electrical conductivity through the water.
All right. Help us understand the impact of salinity. Like, what exactly does it – why that?
So salinity becomes important. There's been research in the Colorado River Basin and other and globally, looking at how salt affects not just water but soil. So it affects the rangeland health and vegetation quality and type that's out there for salts in the soils. But then salt in the water, as you increase the amount of salt in water, it can become toxic and lethal to livestock and wildlife in the regions. You always hear the stories about trying to drink seawater. So you can mm-hmm. you can relate that, though seawater is much saltier than what we're talking about. But it's still lethal for livestock.
I'm curious to know, do you do this this measuring in the field? Are you taking samples and bringing them back to the lab?
I get to go in the field. So yeah. we are looking at 70 impoundments on public lands, mostly Bureau of Land Management lands in Butte and Harding counties. And so we go out and visit each one of these impoundments, and we have a probe that measures conductivity in the water. And we measure it in a couple of places so we can get an accurate measurement per each impoundment. And we do that right now. We're doing it once a month.
All right. What are you finding out? What are you learning? You said you started this in 2018. So the conditions, how have they changed?
So 2018 and 2019 were kind of some of the wettest years we've had. So we had stock dams full and overfull of water and very low conductivities that were all within what the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Society, suggests as usable for livestock. In 2019, we came back out in April of this year, and we found very quickly two things. One, we started having some of these impoundments were gone. They had dried out completely based on the drought. And then the second thing, most of these impoundments, we didn't have a single impoundment. It was over 4,000 microsiemens per centimeter. That's the measurement of conductivity that we look at. At 5,000, it becomes not as quality of water, and at about 15,000 microsiemens per centimeter, it can become lethal. We found in 2019, none of them were over 4,000. This year, we had 6% over 15,000. And as we've gone out every month, we've seen an increase in those as those impoundments, there's no freshwater recharge to dilute, so they keep concentrating in those areas.
Are they irrigated then to deal with that problem, or is it a matter of keeping livestock away from them?
They're not irrigated. There's no real way to at this point to mediate them. Most of the ranchers are out there. They're used to drought. They know what they're mm-hmm. doing and where they're at, and they know how to guide. But we've found a few that weren't expected to be as high. So what's going on now is they'll use the ones that are of good quality, and there's a lot of water trucks starting to come in sure. to supplement the natural water that would be out there.
You can see this with your eyes and measure it scientifically. I've been hearing these sort of rumors about sheep getting stuck in the mud and not making it to the stock dam. Is that a rumor? Or where is that coming from?
No, that's the truth. So, in northwestern South Dakota, the bedrock is pure shale, and if you've ever walked out into it after a rain, that clay turns into a gumbo and it becomes very thick and very heavy. So, on the edge of these impoundments, as they recede down, you still have water in that pure shale, and it becomes a very thick, quick clay almost. And small lambs and sheep will get in there, and they'll get mired. They'll go down to their chest and not be able to get out. I have had that experience personally and gone down past my knee while I'm walking out trying to take measurements, even though I'm being safe. And I can get out. Cattle usually can work themselves out. Sheep just, they're in. They don't have leverage to do it.
Wow.
So they will lose. So that's a secondary danger for this drought that no one really talks about as well.
Yeah. What happens next in your research?
In my research. So where we're going with our research is we're doing a characterization and assessment of the area. It's never been looked at in this way before. And all of this is to give information back to the land managers and the stakeholders so we can start to look at areas. If we need to put more impoundments in, where can we place them where we're not going to run the risk of the salinity? Do they need to remediate or remove these to bring the rangeland health back to a level? Those are the questions that they get to answer, that I get to feed them some information to help them make those answers.
Yeah. Patrick Kozak, you're welcome back anytime. He's a scientist. He's a graduate of South Dakota Mines. Thank you for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, and you have a wonderful day.
Ahead on the program, we've been talking a lot lately about the work of scholar Ibram X. Kendi. Now, Kendi speaks to South Dakotans directly. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, the national conservative groups that funded the ballot audit in Arizona claiming the vote was fraudulent. We talked with The New Yorker's Jane Mayer about her new article, The Big Money Behind the Big Lie. She writes that those wealthy conservatives now want to let state legislators overturn elections. Join us.
This afternoon at 2:01 Mountain on SDPB. Program funding by Arts South Dakota, encouraging the development of artistic talent and appreciation in all South Dakotans. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
As part of our Early Learners Initiative, or ELI, SDPB presents Parenting Minutes. These bite-sized videos for parents and caregivers have useful everyday tips for raising curious and confident learners. There's always time to learn. Watch for Parenting Minutes on SDPB TV or visit us online at sdpb.org/ELI. And don't forget to sign up for our ELI newsletter.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Ibram X. Kendi is a National Book Award-winning author and a leading anti-racism scholar. Kendi is the second person to hold the Boston University-endowed Andrew W. Mellon Professorship. The first was Holocaust survivor and 1986 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Kendi's books include How to Be Anti-Racist and Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. His work and ideas have been singled out by Governor Kristi Noem in Executive Order 2021-11 as being, quote, infused with factual errors, end quote. I connected with Kendi yesterday via Zoom to talk about his work and his response to the governor's words.
If we were to take this off of race for a second, what would you say is the biggest sports rivalry in the state of South Dakota?
I'm a big sports person. Yeah, USD versus SDSU, two state colleges. Yeah.
All right. So let's say if USD was playing SDSU, you know, every year in basketball. I'm a basketball guy, right? And USD was winning year in and year out, 40 straight years, right? folks at the state college, please, just bear with me. There's only two explanations as to what's happening, as to why that outcome is happening. Either it's because USD is the superior team, right? They have better players, or there is not an equality of outcome. In other words, the rules are not fair for both of those teams. And so when you have equal teams and you have unequal outcomes, what it leads people to believe is, well, are there actually equality of opportunity? And that's really what we're asking about. You know, when, you know, so many people are, we, Black people, for instance, are more likely to be incarcerated. They're more likely to be impoverished. There's this huge racial wealth gap. There are all these racial disparities and inequities. And so if white people and Black people and Native people and Latinx people and Asian people are equals, meaning no group is superior or inferior, then why do we have all these unequal outcomes? But some then argue that, well, it's not the case that we're equals. So I guess that's what I've really been trying to ask really the American people, which is that when you have equal teams, when you have equal groups and unequal outcomes, then it could be the case that the policies and practices are not fair.
So if we have high school graduation rates in this state, there is a significant gap between Native American students' graduation rates and non-Native students' graduation rates. Similar thing, you would look at the rate and say, what is happening here? Because you do not believe that Native American students can't learn. You don't believe that we are some non-Natives are somehow culturally superior than Natives. So you would be asking the question of, what are the policies that are leading to this? Am I on
Precisely.
The right track?
Yeah, because if, let's say, if Native students and non-Native students are equals, then it's a reasonable thing to ask, well, what's going on sort of behind the scenes? What's happening at the policy level? What's happening when it comes to the practices or the way different students are being treated? Now, if some believe that Native students are intellectually inferior, that they don't work as hard, that their parents don't, quote, encourage education as much, I think it's important for those folks to realize that that's connoting Native inferiority. That's a racist idea. But if we believe that the racial groups are equals and there's not an equal outcome, then why is it an extremist idea to ask, well, what's going on that we don't have these equal outcomes between these equal groups?
You don't necessarily have to change people's minds in order to change the outcomes if you change the policy.
I think the part of the difficulty, especially in the course of American history, is in many cases when we have sought to change outcomes that would close these racial disparity gaps, the opponents of those gaps, particularly the political opponents of those efforts to change policy to create more equity, have claimed directly or indirectly, to particularly to white Americans, that somehow they would lose or things would be taken away from them. And policy after policy, when we instituted equitable policies, it helped everyone. It helped white folks too, you know, but I don't think people realize that. I don't think people of all races realize the more we create an egalitarian society of true equal opportunity, that it's going to help everyone.
Let's talk about this executive order. Governor Kristi Noem, who's governor of South Dakota, has said, you know, she's not decided anything about running for president, but largely throughout the nation, she's considered to be someone with presidential intentions. She issues this executive order to essentially put a hold on all civics and history grants from our State Department of Education until our legislative session meets in January, because we are expecting some legislation about history and civics curriculum, grant guidelines, and what have you. In this executive order, she mentions the 1619 Project, and she mentions the work of Ibram X. Kendi, and says that it is riddled with factual errors. And even though there's this federal grant process that it had his name in it, now his name's been taken out, but just in name only. So she's very concerned about things that are coming from the federal government to South Dakota schools. And that has caused great debate here about censorship, about what we're teaching our students. But I'm very curious, which is why I reached out to you, when you hear that news that you've listed by name as being someone who is dangerous to the education of our children and their feelings of patriotism and what Governor Noem says is honest education, what do you make of that?
I think it is certainly, I'm a scholar, you know, I'm a professor, and in my line of work, we are governed by truth and science and evidence. And so we speak from the evidence. We speak from facts. We conduct research before we talk. And so it's kind of difficult for me because the thought of using another person's work or name as almost like a political football is something that is just so foreign to me. I'm not going to, first and foremost, not going to critique someone's work I haven't read. And I would encourage the governor, if there's any factual errors in my book, to please send me a note so I could, you know, correct those. I have yet to find them, but no book is perfect, and I've written quite a few books. But it's difficult because I've also heard that the governor stated that has spoken out against indoctrinating students, but she also speaks about that she wants students to learn that America remains the shining example of exceptionalism throughout the history of the world, that's a doctrine. The idea that racism does not exist is a doctrine. And so I just want us to just at least be honest that you may not agree with certain ideas, but to claim your own ideas are not a form of indoctrination, is just blatantly, is just certainly not true. I do appreciate that she has stated that she wants our students to be taught a history that studies both the triumphs, and the mistakes, because I share that. In my work, I not only chronicle the history of racism, but also the history of anti-racism. And I don't argue that America is essentially either, or even a person is essentially either. I track those times in which Americans have instituted policies that created more equity, and they've instituted more policies that have created more inequity. And I've also tracked when Americans, including white Americans, have fought for more equitable policies. I'd love for white students to learn about white abolitionists who fought against slavery, or white folks who challenged sort of settler colonialism against Native people. I mean, these are the stories our students need to learn about.
Is there a way, when you create policy, to do a racial impact study so that policy can be evaluated for its impacts before?
Yes, there is. And just as we have a CBO, obviously, in Washington, D.C., that predicts with its best guess, the economic sort of impact of, let's say, proposed tax bill. Mm-hmm. So too, can we create like a CBO for equity to examine, what type of impact, any policy would have on equity, or inequity, or even not only equity or inequity, but even the way we see the world. So to give an example, a recent Reuters Ipsos poll found that the majority of Americans don't know what critical race theory is. And then of those who claim they do know, only 5% were able to actually answer correct questions based on the actual definition of this term. So we have this massive wave of people who are against what they consider to be critical race theory, and only a very small percentage of Americans actually know what critical race theory truly is. And so those are things we can measure.
You are not the father of critical race theory. It's been around since long before you were born. Yes?
I think that's probably been one of the most difficult aspects for me, because your governor and others have described critical race theory as an historical discipline when it's a legal discipline. It comes out of law schools. It doesn't come out of history departments. And it emerged in law schools in the 1970s. And many reports point to 1981 as the sort of birth year of critical race theory. I wasn't born until 1982.
Your research for Stamped from the Beginning, this is the National Book Award winner, is a hefty volume of research of racist ideas. Take us back to saying, I need to research these racist ideas and how they came to be. What drew you on that path?
I think what drew me on the path was really realizing that such a book, such a sweeping history that really chronicles the origins of specifically anti-Black racist ideas in 15th century Portugal, and really tracks their development in Western Europe, their settling in what later became the United States, and their course their development and redevelopment sort of over time, to the day that such a book did not exist. And I think in early parts of that research, I realized that some of those anti-Black racist ideas were ideas that I held. And I wanted to know, where did these ideas come from? How did they get into even my mind? Why did I end up thinking that there was something wrong with Black people, just as other people do as well? And I think what's fascinating to me is when you realize who created an idea like Black people are stupid, or Black neighborhoods are dangerous, or Black women are hypersexual, when you realize who created an idea and then for what political purpose, oftentimes to benefit them in some political capacity, oftentimes to divide sort of everyday ordinary people, you begin to say, whoa, I've been manipulated. People can control me because they're getting me to think that the problem are those other people who don't look like me. And they're consistently sort of getting me enraged and angry. All the while, they're not doing their job and making my life better.
Do you have any final thoughts for teachers in South Dakota, students in South Dakota, parents who care deeply about what their students learn and are now attending school board meetings and talking about these ideas often in a very stressful environment? What do you want them to understand about your work that maybe they're not going to get from the normal political rhetoric?
I just think in general, we as teachers, because I consider myself to be a teacher, more college teacher, one of the things we encourage our students to do, whether they're 5 years old or 22, is to go to the source. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, my work has been mangled in all types of ways. Like, so to give an example, I have a whole chapter called White, in which I directly challenge anyone who makes a claim that there's something inferior or wrong or evil about white people. I directly challenge that and speak out against it. You know, all the while, people have completely skipped over that chapter to sort of paint me as something that I did not argue in that text. And so I would encourage the teachers, you know, if they're curious to learn about my work, or they're curious to learn about the 1619 Project, or they're curious to learn about the work of actual critical race theorists, you know, to read that work and read it for themselves. And I would really encourage even non-teachers, we're all learners, right? But I would also say to teachers, I think the American people in general, specifically during the pandemic, learned just how crucial teachers were to our community, just how much we depended on them. And certainly we were thinking about that in terms of having someone to care for our children so we could work. But also our children spend so much time with these, with our teachers, and our teachers have such a huge responsibility, you know, on their hands. And part of that responsibility is really conveying to young minds the world that they're living in, preparing them for this world, you know, preparing them for all these different looking people, you know, in the world, preparing them to see the human rainbow and see themselves on that human rainbow, you know, and appreciate all of our beautiful diversity, preparing them to realize that just because, you know, a group of people, whether Black or Native people, have less, that doesn't mean there are less. And so there may be some rules that could be leading to that, or that just because a group of people may have more doesn't mean they are more, or teaching that young Native, you know, girl, there's nothing wrong with you because of the color of your skin. I mean, that is so powerful, you know, in a nation where that girl is constantly being told directly and indirectly there's something wrong with them, or even teaching that 10-year-old white boy, you are special when you are nice. You are special, you know, when you share, but you're not special because of the color of your skin, you know, and teaching our children that. I mean, we can make such a difference, you know, in the lives of our children. And that's why I just so appreciate teachers, you know, and everything that they're doing. And they have long stood up to politicians who've been trying to get them to indoctrinate our students in one way or another. And instead, our teachers have stated, no, we're just going to tell the truth, whether you like it or not.
You can find and share this conversation with Ibram X. Kendi from our website, sdpb.org/news. Let's take a moment now to consider the impact of the drought in South Dakota. Close to 90% of the state is under drought conditions. Well, what does that mean if your livelihood depends on the weather? Woolsey, South Dakota farmer Bill Chase took a few minutes during a recent soil health seminar to share his experience with SDPB reporter Laura Rohde.
I started my first year farming was 1976. And in 1980, we bought the farm we currently live on, and we completely dried up that year as well. 81, yes, it was 81, not 80. Well, it just complicates things. You not only have to plant the crop and harvest the crop, but you need to monitor the crop accordingly. You need to evaluate whether the things you're going to do for that crop will pay. Do you want to add extra fungicides, fertilizers, all these things? If it's not going to rain, why would you do those things and spend more money on a crop that you know is not going to be any more than average at best? So it just adds things to it. And being the livestock producer like we are, it adds things there because we're looking for different areas to graze our cattle, which means there's more fencing to be done. Or in our case, in some instances, we're hauling water to the cattle because the dugouts are dried up. Well, we have a practice, if anything, of having too much grass for our cattle. We don't stock them. We always have 5 acres for a pair. And I know there are some that don't have that many acres. We've always stocked our pastures lately. And many times, including this year, that's a good thing, because if there is some grass from last year out there, we're utilizing that now. The crops, you really don't do anything different, because in the spring you're optimistic you're going to have a good crop. So you do everything thinking that it's going to rain. And then when you get to this time of year, you just deal with what you have. My wife Kathy and I farm just northwest of here, and we're first generation farmers. We started right after high school, and we're still there. Been there 40 plus years now. Oh, yes, I'm glad she's there. I'm glad she's been there for 40 years, so she knows there are good times and there are bad times. And this isn't necessarily a bad time, it's just a different time that we have to get through.
Ahead on the program, South Dakota Home Garden, Eric Helland is with us. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. With hate crimes on the rise, states are debating the merits of teaching Asian American history in schools. It's personal for Won Hee Shin, who never learned any of it in the classroom.
I didn't even know that I could be fully American. I mean, that's something that, a concept that I didn't know that this country would allow me to have until I became an adult.
Next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. It's time now for our weekly South Dakota Home Garden segment. Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls. He's joining me now in STPB's Kirby Family Studio. Hi, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing well. There was a little rain. We've been talking about a little rain, and not for everybody, but there was in my yard yesterday, last night.
A little damp, and there's not as much smoke.
for us.
A little bit cooler.
Right now. Yeah, so it's nice. It's nice. It's good summer. I mean, it's actually getting to the end of summer, unfortunately.
No, it's not. Take that back.
Okay, I take that back.
We are over the middle point.
Yes, we are.
We're over the hill.
Yeah.
We're over the solstice hill.
Yeah.
Okay, hydrangeas is our topic for today.
Yes.
These lovely flowers. I love these. Let's describe them to people. Once again, I'm going to ask you for radio listeners to tell me what a flower looks like.
So the foliage is 90% of it, all of it, most of the hydrangea foliage is green. Okay. Mm-hmm. Does that help? We're setting the stage.
Right.
It's green. Yes. Green stage, so green green flowers or green leaves. Where it really becomes interesting is the flowers. And then the heights and the shapes and all of that stuff. And then what the flowers do. So typically, in all cases of a hydrangea, a flower is usually in a big softball shape. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be the whole circular spherical shape, or it might be half of that, or it might be conical. But then that flower is actually made up of hundreds of other little tiny flowers that make up this gigantic flower. And that's where it just becomes so cool. So from a distance, it looks like a gigantic flower, one solid flower. But then when you get up close to it and you just kind of go into there, it's kind of the Monet's masterpiece of just a bunch of tiny little flowers making up another flower.
Yes.
So is that...
It's like the Monet of flowers. I
love
this.
You like that one?
Yes.
Yeah,
and you can do all kinds of things decoratively with these because of the variety of colors.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the color palettes that are available.
Oh, geez. Okay. So typically what people are seeing right now, like today, when you're seeing a lot of the white hydrangea, usually a smooth or an Annabelle type hydrangea, and that one is the one that you can dry very easily. So it might be a little bit too late to grab them and cut them and dry them. But typically you want to wait cut them to dry them when the flowers haven't turned white, when they're still a little bit green. You'll have your best success there. But then you get into pinks, and then you get into blues, and then you get into reds, but then there's different shades of pink. So there's the names are fun. There's like Pinky Winky. There's Quick Fire. Yeah. There's Blue Wave. There's just lots of different names, and they're kind of fun. And they're all Bobo is another one. so there's the hydrangeas are really made a strong presence in the past probably 10 years, and we continue to see new ones and updated ones and better ones, and they're just a ton of fun.
The ones I have in my yard are pretty hardy because I have experimented with, whacking them back at the wrong time of the year. And, they expand, they come back. They come back pretty beautifully every year. Is this a good hardy plant for people who are not total green thumb people?
Yeah. So this type of plant loves it on, it's a good, you could not screw it up if you have it on like on the east side or even on the west side, but it gets a little bit of shade from a tree that's nearby in the late summer. Or late afternoon, excuse me. So the plant is very, very simple. You don't do anything with it until maybe the fall or the spring. Some of the hydrangeas will come back on the previous year's wood. Mm-hmm. Some of them will have new shoots that start from the base every single year. So there's lots of different things. They are very simple. They're easy to maintain. They're not a problem for diseases and pests.
Sure.
So it's a good.
Mine are getting pretty tall. They're a little leggy.
Okay.
That's okay as long as they're still standing strong. Or can they get? Can that be a problem?
Are they white?
Yes.
Okay, so the white ones will get because they throw that big head, that big flower on there, and so it's pulling up a bunch of moisture. All of a sudden, it starts to get a little bit weak. And then a little bit of a breeze or a storm will actually flatten them.
Okay.
And then that's just part of it. And then they'll dry out, and then those plants will pop back up. Keep the foliage on the green leaves because the green leaves, of course, are helping produce all of the food. And then just wait for fall because it's a lot of times people would let them dry out on the plant themselves, then trim them off and bring them inside.
Yeah. This is my favorite part is the, I think I told you this last year when we talked about hydrangeas, but my grandmother had this almost like a bowl vase, like a mm-hmm. low, flat piece of glass that just held enough water to float her hydrangea bulbs in. And I used to just be mesmerized by that. And maybe even had a swan on it.
And as
there was something about it that I was just enchanted with all the time.
So my grandmother used to have them, and I used to climb underneath them because when they're really tall, the different spacing of the plants up above, so you had your little fort underneath there. And there's a certain smell to them, too.
Mm-hmm. My dog used to do that, by the way. You and my dog. My daughter made the house in the lilacs. The dog made a little, you know, a little dugout in the hydrangeas.
I doubt I could fit in underneath the hydrangeas now, but...
Yeah, probably not. You've grown a bit taller
wider.
Since that time. mostly tall. Eric Helland, let's tell people a little bit about how to be part of the South Dakota Home Garden community. You can go to Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The hashtag is SD Home Garden, and there are new segments of the digital series posted every week at sdpb.org/SD Home Garden. Eric, thanks for being here. As always, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Superior Siren is a folk collective out of Duluth, Minnesota, featuring Laura Sellner on guitar and vocals, along with backing from cello, bass, and drums. Musical inspiration rises from Lake Superior and Siren mythology. Their latest EP is called Kill Your Darlings, and it was released in May. Laura Sellner is with us now ahead of her performance at the Levitt Shell in Sioux Falls. Laura, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
As soon as I saw the title of the EP, Kill Your Darlings, I was immediately in because for anybody who loves writing, this Murder Your Darlings, Kill Your Darlings is this hugely, often taught writing lesson or lesson for creatives. Tell us a little bit where, for you, this the title of this new EP came from and how it sort of intersects with the work that you were creating at the time.
Yeah, so the literary reference I connect with Kill Your Darlings is to rid of unnecessary elements for the sake of the overall story. And so I really found that that title for this EP fit well because I've been writing these songs for years since the full band released the full-length album in 2018. And so I have almost 3 years worth of songs that are just roaming around within me. And I wanted to release them and share them with the audience in order to make space for new things to grow. And as well, I feel like these songs that are on this EP are about past relationships, past lessons that I've learned, past versions of myself that I'm letting go of.
Were you writing these songs during the pandemic, before that? Like, how did the experience that you had as an artist during a time of pandemic change some of your work or influence your work?
I wrote a couple of these songs or kind of brought them back to life during the pandemic and reworked them. I think that the pandemic really allowed for space to reflect and kind of go deep into oneself. And I found that within the shadows, within the dark parts of yourself, there are opportunities for growth. And so I think that was brought forth into some of these songs.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about this influence of siren legend and mythology, especially connected to a sense of place. Like the Great Lakes.
Yes, so I'm from Duluth, and I grew up swimming in Lake Superior and always felt very connected to water. And as I started writing music, I found that I had sort of a different vibe, somewhat eerie, a alluring. And my lyricism, I find that it's really going to hard emotions and reflecting on things that I need to process in order to heal. And my intention is to help other people to heal. And so it's kind of uncomfortable at times. The music is very deep and evokes a lot of emotion. And so the siren theme, the alluring but somewhat dangerous theme, really fit with the music that I was trying to create, and then also just went well with Lake Superior and where I'm from.
What I love about that too is sometimes, you know, artists are afraid to look deeply at their own experience, and they think that they need to go elsewhere for that inspiration. And it just sort of plants this sense of ownership of your own lived experience into this beautiful, beautiful work. So Superior Siren will be at Leavitt at the Falls Saturday evening. You've done White Wall sessions. You've done the Sioux River Folk Festival. You tour often in Minnesota and that area as well. Hank Harris, another one of our favorites, is opening for you with that program Saturday. That's kicking off at 6:30. Laura, we're going to leave people with a little bit of music here. And I want to say thank you very much for being here with us today. We'll put some links up on our website to her work as well. Laura Selner, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Here is some Superior Siren ahead of this weekend's concert at Leavitt at the Falls. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.
Hit center and stark. She's waiting for the train. She'll see her man when she dies. Pours a tall glass of brandy, sips sweetly and hums. Tears fall much too easily. Won't stop till she's gone. She's a